Good evening, everyone. Hello and welcome to Cure Talks. I'm Priya Menon, Scientific Media Editor at Cure Talks, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on fertility preservation for young adult cancer survivors. This is our 82nd episode, and we are talking about preserving fertility if you have been diagnosed with cancer in your 20s or 30s. It is important to know your options before your chemotherapy or radiation starts. And to do so, we have with us two very distinguished panelists. Sulekhet Bhat is Emmy Award winner, New York Times columnist, cancer ninja, and a health advocate. Sulekha was diagnosed with acute myeloid leukemia at a very young age of 22 years. We also have with us Dr. Andrea Ray, reproductive endocrinologist at Dominion Fertility in Arlington. She completed her fellowship in reproductive endocrinology and infertility at the New York University Fertility Center with the NYU School of Medicine in New York City. Welcome to Cure Talks. My co-host for the evening is Matt Goldman. Matt is a multiple myeloma survivor and chronicles his myeloma journey on his blog, Matt vs. Myeloma. I would like to remind our listeners that towards the end of the discussion, we will be answering questions sent in via email by our listeners. If you want to ask a question live, please press 1 on your keypad to let us know, and we will bring you on air to ask them. We all know cancer diagnosis can be heartbreaking, and if you are in your 20s, 30s, more so, since this can now affect career plans, financial independence, and fertility. Fertility preservation is often not introduced to young adult cancer patients, and in the coming hour, we will try to learn more about avenues and options available for preserving your fertility in young adults who are diagnosed with cancer. With that, it's over to Matt. Matt, you're on air.
All right. Thanks, Priya. And thanks, Doctor, and thanks, Sulekha, for participating. I think we got a lot of stuff to cover, so I'm just going to jump right into it. I've got a few questions for you, Doctor. First, just beginning from the basics, will cancer treatments affect fertility? And are there, I know every cancer is different, but are there ways to treat cancer without compromising fertility?
Yes, thank you, Matt, and thank you, Priya and Sulekha. I think what we know is that whether the cancer treatment will affect fertility will often depend upon what type of cancer a person has and what the proposed treatment really might be. We know the big offender really is chemotherapy, and chemo has the potential to render a man or a woman temporarily or even permanently infertile. Chemo works because it targets rapidly growing cells, and when we want to fight cancer, that's what we want to do, is stop those rapidly growing cells. But unfortunately, that also takes out sperm and eggs alike. And for women, this can mean this speeds up their biological clock and even leads to temporary or even permanent menopause. And there can be other treatments like surgery that can impact fertility if they involve the removal or compromise certain reproductive organ systems. Radiation also has the potential to affect fertility, but again, that's going to depend on the target organ and the patient's overall treatment plan. But there may be alternative ways to treat the cancer without compromising a patient's fertility, keeping in mind that the primary goal is, of course, to get rid of the cancer first.
Thanks. What are some of the more common cancers that might affect a person in his or her reproductive age, the 20s and 30s?
Sure. I think what we see in young adults, they may experience similar cancers to older adults as well. But they also see breast cancer, non-Hodgkin's and Hodgkin's lymphoma. melanoma, sarcomas. There can be gynecological cancers of the female system, like cervical cancer or ovarian cancer, testicular cancer in men, colorectal cancer, other types of leukemia as well as brain and spinal cord tumors.
So quite a few different ones.
Absolutely.
Yeah. If a patient hasn't taken steps to preserve fertility before cancer, before their diagnosis, I guess, how do you evaluate opportunities for drug holidays if a patient expresses interest in conception?
This is a great question. Not everyone has the opportunity to pursue fertility preservation before cancer treatment. And typically, I would have to say that the opportunity to stop and take a drug holiday is usually a decision that's made between the patient and their oncologist. And often, again, it's going to depend on what type of cancer they have, how old they are, and what their overall prognosis is. But I can say that the most common situation I've seen in my practice are breast cancer survivors who often are in their 30s. And, you know, they've completed their treatment, but they want to stop something like tamoxifen earlier than, say, the 5 or 10 years that may be recommended. And these are often very critical reproductive years for women, and a few years can really make a difference in terms of their fertility. And so what I would do is work together with them and their oncologist in this decision process and try to evaluate their fertility at this point in time, and then offer advice and options about what their chances of pregnancy would be if they tried now versus waiting in a few years. But, you know, I really can't emphasize enough that we are certainly a team, and these cases always require a multidisciplinary approach.
Mm-hmm. And is it solely the oncologist who may consult with the patient before they begin treatment about fertility issues, or is a special some other specialist brought into the discussion, or is that kind of the patient's choice?
Oh, that's another good question. I think the oncologists really serve as the front line. And really, since 2006, there's been some clear recommendations from the American Society of Clinical Oncology that oncologists really should be addressing the issues of infertility before patients start treatment, and if possible, to really refer these patients on to reproductive specialists. You know, the oncologist has so many different facets of their patient's treatment plan that they have to coordinate that they really often don't have the time to discuss fertility to the extent that is necessary. And really, that's where I come in. I mean, as a fertility specialist, this is what I do all day. And we're always happy to meet with patients for consultation and spend time so they understand their options. And, you know, the earlier the better, too, because it gives us time to really provide them with the widest array of options. For example, you know, if they were to go through egg freezing, it may take 2 or 3 weeks at a minimum. You know, but there often can be other people involved besides myself and the oncologist and the surgical oncologist. Sometimes we also have the patient speak to maternal fetal medicine specialists. These are obstetricians who specialize in high-risk pregnancies. We also may have them meet with genetic counselors as well as some psychosocial support teams as well. So, like I said, a team approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. Suleika, I have a few questions for you. And first of all, I just want to say I read your latest article in the Times, and congratulations on your full remission and getting your port out. That's awesome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yes, it's been an eventful day. I actually just flew in from India, so I'm probably more on Priya's time than I am on New York time right now.
Okay, so you were diagnosed when you were 22. Did your medical team discuss fertility issues with you?
I have the utmost respect for my medical team. They're incredible people who are brilliant and who are really dedicated to getting me healthy. But unfortunately, fertility was not something that was discussed with me at all. I found out a few days after my diagnosis, then I started to Google the side effects of the chemotherapy treatments I was scheduled to undergo in less than a week. And for me, the shock of imagining that I was going to be infertile was in some ways greater than the shock of actually receiving a cancer diagnosis. Mm-hmm. I had a shot at being cured, but infertility felt permanent. And at age 22, I hadn't even begun to think about starting a family one day. That wasn't something that was on my radar. And it felt like a major breach of trust with my doctors early on in the conversation. I couldn't help but wonder what else they weren't telling me.
So when you did a little of your own research and you had that realization, how difficult or how challenging was it for you to bring the issue up with your doctors or with your team?
I brought it up immediately with them the next day. And their concern was that because of the aggressive nature of my disease, I didn't have the time to take those 2 or 3 weeks off before entering the hospital to be in treatment. But once they really explained to me how important this was to me, they ended up agreeing in the end to carve out 2 weeks for me to undergo egg preservation treatments.
Before you started your treatment, they gave you the
treatment. Before I started my treatment. And there was some risk involved to that decision, but for me, preserving my ability to be a mother one day really felt like a lifeline to an already uncertain future.
And did they offer any other options besides that, just given kind of the immediate need for you to start treatment?
At the time, this was in 2012, they didn't offer me other options. I know I've heard from friends who have recently been diagnosed about other options that they've been able to pursue, but for me that was really the only option. What mm-hmm. surprised me, though, was that getting the okay from my doctors to get those fertility treatments wasn't the only hurdle ahead. Unfortunately, in the United States, most insurance companies don't cover fertility preservation treatments for cancer patients, and those treatments can cost upwards from $20,000, which is a heavy bill to tack on before you've even begun your cancer treatment.
Right. So I guess going back to you, Doctor, what are some of the options available for both men and women for fertility preservation? And touching on Suleika's point, what are some of the options given the financial cost of fertility preservation?
Great, great questions, and certainly an inspiring story from Suleika about being your own advocate, and that ultimately a lot of this is a discussion in between patient and doctor and weighing risks as well. And certainly, just to echo what she said, I mean, a very common thing that we hear from patients is that it's not just a cancer diagnosis; it's being told that they may be infertile, and that for a lot of patients, like Suleika said, that's even worse than the cancer itself. But getting back to your question, I think, for men it is always much simpler. Sperm banking really is still the cornerstone of treatment options for men. It's simple, and usually even just one sample can be aliquoted into multiple vials, which gives the man multiple attempts at pregnancy in the future. And that can be either through thawing that sperm and undergoing inseminations with his partner or IVF. And the sperm really survived the freezing and thawing process quite well. So there's really no considerable impact on the freezing process in terms of the chances of that being fertile afterwards. For women, there are several different options now. Suleika talked about egg banking, and this is certainly really gaining momentum. the experimental label's been lifted as of 2012, and it really remains the best option for single women or for couples who really want to avoid the psychological burden of creating embryos, particularly in the setting of a life-threatening disease. But the problem with egg freezing over the years is that the eggs, for lack of a better description, are really prone to freezer burn, and they really have not survived the thawing process very well. So we haven't really done a lot of egg freezing until recently. There have been improvements in the freezing techniques with vitrification, and now we see excellent thaw survival and embryo development, which translates into good pregnancy rates for patients. So that's becoming a lot more popular option. But traditionally, embryo banking, you know, that has been another time-tested technique. It's been used in regular IVF for several decades now. And embryos themselves survive the freezing and thawing process much better. And the success rates are much more predictable because they're typically based on the woman's age at the time of freezing. And this is usually the best option for couples that are already in a committed relationship. And beyond that, for women, I think we're starting to see more use of what's called medical suppression with medications like Lupron. This is an injection that a woman can take before she undergoes chemotherapy, which basically puts her into like a hormonal menopause. And it's been debated back and forth about whether this is beneficial. But a recent article actually just came out in the New England Journal of Medicine last week that did show that for breast cancer patients who had Lupron, that they had a lower incidence of ovarian failure, more of them got pregnant, and there was actually a higher overall survival. So there looks like there's some promising options becoming for Lupron as well. And there's some experimental options as well that are usually best done in an research or university setting, and this would include things like testicular tissue freezing, ovarian tissue freezing, or even in vitro maturation. And these are for patients who typically are younger, you know, before puberty.
And this might be a dumb question. What makes eggs more sensitive to freezer burn than sperm or even stem cells, for example?
That's a good question. I mean, I think the eggs typically have a higher water content. So the slow freezing techniques were unsuccessful at preventing ice crystals from forming, which really were damaging to the eggs. But compositions of sperm tolerate that very well.
Mm-hmm. And doctor, do you mind if I chime in with a question?
Absolutely.
One thing that I've thought about, and I know that a lot of other young adults think about, is that typically when people freeze eggs, they use them within a year or two or 3 years. When you're looking at teenagers or women in their early 20s who are freezing eggs who conceivably may not use them for another decade, does that increase the risk of freezer burn, or have there been any studies that show the differences in success rates between short and long-term use of those eggs?
It's a good question. I think what we've seen, certainly with embryo banking, which has been around a lot longer, that the duration of freezing does not seem to impact the results. And that's what we've seen with sperm banking as well, and I would assume the same is for the egg freezing. The risks with egg freezing are really at the time of the freeze and at the time of the thaw. But once they're frozen, they sort of remain in that dormant state, and they can, you know, with embryo freezing, we've certainly seen patients go greater than 10 years, you know, with good results.
And if a patient doesn't have a chance to do fertility patient before they start treatment, like Suleika, for example, had a 2-week window. But if somebody doesn't have a window to do that and they sort of they're in their active treatment and at some point they do want that drug holiday while they're still being actively treated, what kind of tests need to be done to know if the sperm or the eggs would even be viable? Is there any sort of genetic screening or what's what's looked at?
That's a good question. So I think you're saying, well, while someone's still in treatment, I think it would depend what the treatment is. I think while they're still in active chemotherapy, it would be, it's not typically when we would undergo egg freezing, but it would be a discussion with, you know, the oncologist to see if there would be a window of time that, you know, could be carved out. Sometimes, you know, anecdotally, I've noticed in these situations, women may not respond to the medications that we give them as well because the ovaries are in such a dormant state. And I think you asked and touched upon some genetic screening as well and how to mm-hmm. assess fertility. So, I mean, typically, you know, to assess fertility for men, again, it always just kind of boils down to a simple semen analysis. And then if that's abnormal and they are at a juncture where they're looking to preserve fertility, you know, we often would handle these cases in conjunction with a urologist, particularly one that may subspecialize in infertility. And then for women, to assess fertility, we're looking at usually a combination of tests, and this would include typically a pelvic sonogram to look at the ovaries. That gives us our best view of the ovaries without having to look at them through surgery, and that's very simple to do. And then we would also combine that information with some basic hormone tests, which are just blood tests that we would draw, and use that data to sort of extrapolate how many eggs are there in the ovary at that time and whether, you know, that can be translated into their fertility.
And is there any way to do any screening for chance of birth defects and trying to minimize that?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, we talk a lot about genetic screening now and screening to really all of our patients, not just those that are undergoing cancer treatment. And there's multiple options, really, for women and for couples. And there are options before conception and after conception. So before trying to get pregnant, a woman can typically undergo some screening to identify genes that they may be carriers for. So this would, you know, include things like cystic fibrosis or sickle cell disease. But particularly for a patient with cancer, this may include genetic testing for, say, something like the breast cancer gene, the BRCA gene, or other conditions that may be linked, genetically linked to that patient's condition. And it's important to identify these conditions before conception, because if we can determine that, we may change the way we approach their family planning, because we have the option to do something called PGD, and that means pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, which basically means we can take an embryo and test that embryo and determine whether it has that particular disease and then choose not to put that embryo back into a woman so that she would not carry that gene on, pass that gene on to her child. So that's been very important development in our field. But even for, you know, women without a particular genetic condition who may be a cancer survivor, we can still screen embryos before we put them in her to become pregnant, to look for different chromosomal imbalances, for things like Down syndrome. That this will identify more common causes of infertility and miscarriage. And frankly, we're seeing a lot of this being used as a broader application in all patients seeking fertility treatment now, too. But I think, you know, unfortunately, regardless of whether any genetic screening is done before pregnancy, we still tell those women to undergo their routine screening through their obstetrician when they're pregnant, because there's really no one particular test that rules everything out. But it is truly amazing what we can determine before pregnancy at this point, and we encourage our patients to undergo as much of that as we can.
Mm-hmm. And is there a trend, or are there efforts to temper drugs so they maybe don't permanently impact fertility? And are there different classes of cancer-treating drugs that may be safer than others?
Absolutely. You know, I have to be honest, I'm not familiar with the what's coming down the pike at pharmaceutical companies, but I think this certainly is becoming an area of more active research, and we're starting to look more at long-term fertility outcomes after treatment. For a number of years, cancer research was focused on, and rightfully so, focused on survival and eradicating cancer, as obviously this is always still our number one goal. But as we're getting better at fighting cancer, we are able to focus more on long-term quality of life outcomes as well. And so we're starting to see more studies that measure fertility and markers of fertility and pregnancy after treatment. So we're getting a lot more information now about the drugs that we have. You know, we know that some of the big offenders for men and for women are typically the alkylating agents and some of the heavier doses of radiation. And some of the newer medications that we're seeing that are more, I would say, elegant, targeting certain antibodies or targeting certain receptors, those, on the other hand, tend to be a lot safer, similarly with directed hormone therapies or even more gene therapies. So I do think we're seeing a lot more progress in this area.
Okay. Thanks. Suleika, you touched on it, but maybe you could talk a little bit more about how you made that decision to opt for fertility preservation before you started your treatment.
I think it became pretty clear to me earlier on that my goal for myself wasn't just to be cured, but to have a certain quality of life. I say this a lot in different lectures that I give, but I really believe that health is about adding life to years and not just years to life. That was something that was really important to me. I've always wanted to be a mother. I've always imagined myself having a big family one day, and it was very clear to me that that was something that I wanted to do. To go back to the issue of the financial barrier that a lot of patients face when making that decision, I was fortunate to be connected to several resources by my doctors and a social worker, primarily Fertile Hope, which gives grants to help cover the costs of egg and embryo freezing for cancer patients. Mm-hmm. And then once I had done that, I was connected to something called Verna's Purse, V-E-R-N-A, that helps cover the cost of long-term egg freezing, which can be very expensive. So I have about 11 eggs somewhere in a freezer in Minnesota, which can feel kind of surreal to think about.
Right.
But it does give me a lot of comfort to know that they're there and that I'll at least have the option of trying to have children of my own one day, even if the egg freezing doesn't necessarily work. And really what it taught me, I think, most of all, was that I couldn't just be a passive patient. I needed to educate myself and to inform myself and to advocate for myself, because no matter how brilliant and well-intentioned my medical team was, they didn't always know what was important to me and what was my priority. Every patient is different. And it was a lesson for me in speaking up and asking questions and doing my own research.
Mm-hmm. I guess a question for you, but maybe also the doctor, was there any talk or discussion about if your fertility were to be impacted, any discussion of adoption opportunities later in the future, or that that's something you should or could consider?
Unfortunately, adoption is still a big challenge for cancer patients. A lot of adoption agencies won't adopt out to individuals who have a history of cancer, no matter how far out they are from their treatments. It's something that I don't know a lot about. I know there are a few adoption agencies in the U.S. that focus specifically on working with cancer patients to help them adopt children. But that's something that I think has come as a surprise to certain friends of mine who didn't freeze eggs or embryos and then went to try and adopt and weren't able to do so because of their medical history.
Interesting. Doctor, is there any sort of, it sounds like that maybe what the conversations that you have with your patients and your research is maybe is a little bit unique, that it's not common for oncologists to have this conversation with newly diagnosed patients. Is there any change in how doctors are being trained or their interaction with patients where this is becoming more of a common discussion point?
Absolutely. I think that we are seeing both in the reproductive endocrinology and infertility fields, there is a big interest in research for fertility preservation. And we're starting to talk with oncologists more about that as well. Oncologists as well are becoming more educated in this process, and or if nothing else, just referring to us on a more regular basis to discuss this with their patients. You know, we recognize that for them they have a lot of other things to talk about, and given that this is more our field, you know, they will typically refer to us so that we can explore those options with the patients. And since 2006, it's actually been recommended now that they have this conversation and document that there is a possibility or what the possibilities of infertility would be based on that patient's treatment plan, and allow the patient that option to have a consultation if need be. So, and certainly I think, you know, whenever I meet with these couples or when I meet with women, you know, it's important to consider all the options. And like Sulika talked about adoption, I mean, certainly that can be a challenging route as well, with, you know, no guarantee and a time delay and many costs. But there are other options, too. And certainly if egg banking or embryo banking is not an option before and cancer treatment has already occurred, then women can choose to even look down routes using an egg donor, in other words, eggs from another woman, whether that be an anonymous woman or a family member, or even a donor embryo, which would be an embryo already created through the process of IVF, which could then be, you know, carried in a pregnancy. Or if it's felt that that woman would not be able to carry a pregnancy for different reasons, whether it be unsafe or not possible, she could use what's called a gestational carrier or someone to carry that pregnancy too. So there certainly are a number of options available today, and I do think that we are talking more and more with patients about it, but certainly there's a lot of room for improvement still to go.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. Sulika, I mean, you're obviously in a pretty good place right now in terms of your cancer, but was there ever a time when you were, you know, really in the middle of it all that you thought, maybe I shouldn't have delayed treatment, or do you think delaying treatment for a couple weeks to do fertility preservation impacted your outcome at all?
Honestly, that's not something that ever really crossed my mind. The first few months of my treatment, and certainly after my bone marrow transplant, felt very touch and go. But I think if anything, knowing that I had those eggs gave me a sense of hope for the future. Mm-hmm. I think one decision that was really difficult for me was the decision between eggs and embryos. And I was in a relationship at the time that I'm no longer in. And we had felt very strongly that we wanted to go the embryo route. And the social worker very strongly cautioned us against that because I was so young and because we were in a new relationship. And I think that's a really difficult and personal choice. Now looking back, of course, I feel relieved that I didn't create embryos. And now I can understand the many different ways, legal and personal, that that can become complicated. But I still think it's a really difficult situation to be presented with, because when you are taking that time and delaying treatment, you obviously want to go the route that's most likely to be successful. But there are so many other things to weigh when making that decision.
Right. It's impressive that you were able to be your own advocate and put thought into it, because it just seems like when you're diagnosed, it's just kind of a whirlwind of stuff, right? And a lot of fear, and it's just like, well, I need to get going right away on my treatment because you don't really know what's going on. But it's like I said, it's very impressive that you made those decisions early on.
I think for me, it felt like the only concrete thing that I could wrap my head around. Cancer was something I knew very little about. None of my friends had been sick, and fortunately, no one in my family has had cancer. But motherhood and creating a family, that was something that I had always assumed would just be an option at the very least, and a decision I could make for myself. So I think in terms of advocating for myself, I didn't even really see it as advocacy. It was just a very strong guttural reaction that I had, where I said, you know, I need to at the very least have a conversation about this with my doctors. And I think that's something that's really important. Even when your medical team feels that you can't take those 2 or 3 weeks to do egg or embryo preservation. But I think it's a human right to at least be informed of what may happen to your body.
Right.
Absolutely. And just to echo, if I may echo what Salika said, I think that when patients are given the cancer diagnosis, they have so many things on their plate typically, so many doctor's appointments in a very short period of time, so many, you know, things to consider, let alone considering how serious their relationship might be in at the time, like Salika had talked about. It's truly overwhelming. But I think that we owe it to patients to at least have that conversation and let them know what their options are. And I have some patients that have, realized that there's just too much on my plate, and I don't want to devote any energy to my fertility right now, but I'm really glad I at least understand and I can make an informed decision about that. But right now, I just need to focus on cancer. And there are other patients who feel completely the opposite, who say, you know, this is more important to me than some theoretical risk to my prognosis, and I would rather undergo some type of preservation first. And so I think, you know, being able to have that conversation is helpful no matter what the outcome is and what the patient decides, that they go into it feeling like they have some control in a situation that is very much out of their control at that time.
Mm. Right. And I think, Doctor, the what you just said about a theoretical risk, I think, is really important, because I think you don't really know what the risk is or isn't, or what, you know, what your success is going to be with your treatment or not. So I do think that you're both right. You need to go with what's important to you and follow that path.
Yeah, I think it's, certainly I'm not an oncologist, and I defer that conversation about risk to them always. But a lot of it comes down to patients, too. And, some patients are willing to undertake that risk and say, you know, I'd rather look back and know that I did this, even if it has some consequence, and other patients don't feel that way. They don't want to take any possible chance that may affect their prognosis. So it's really, again, that's a conversation between their oncologists, but you know, it's still important for them to understand their options.
Right. Okay. I think that's it for the questions that I have, but I'm pretty sure Priya has a whole bunch of questions from some of the listeners or registered participants.
Thank you, Matt. I think that was a great discussion. Dr. Ray and Slika, we have a list of questions that we have received from our listeners. I will just read through them. And we can get to answering them. Now, Dr. Ray, the first one is for you. It is, can fertility treatment drugs and hormones adversely affect the cancer patient? If yes, what are those category of fertility drugs that a cancer patient, both male and female, should be aware of?
And this is a great question. I think this is something that all of our patients ask us about. But the short answer is, no, the hormones that are necessary to undergo fertility preservation or IVF in general really have not been shown to increase the risk of cancer in any patients. And this is very reassuring, whether it be cancer survivors or patients undergoing IVF in general. The studies on women conceiving after breast cancer also appear to be very reassuring, and in some cases may actually show a longer life expectancy with pregnancy than without, although it's not clear in some cases whether this is because the woman who has a baby after surviving cancer may be generally a healthier group of women overall. And there have been some studies of women who've undergone fertility preservation, and that also has not shown an increased risk of recurrence. So these, you know, studies, we are ongoing. Obviously, there's a lot more data needed, but it appears to be reassuring so far. But I think, you know, what we do see is that particularly for breast cancer patients, especially those with hormonally responsive tumors or estrogen receptor-positive tumors, there certainly is this theoretical risk of increasing the risk of recurrence with any kind of exposure to estrogen. And estrogen, we know, is a hormone that is inherent to fertility treatment and pregnancy. And so even though the studies look reassuring because of this theoretical risk, we certainly always take that extra precaution with these women when they undergo fertility treatment, and we administer a class of medication called aromatase inhibitors. And these are medications that work by lowering estrogen levels and keep those estrogen levels to a minimum. But, you know, in keeping that in mind, the period of time in which hormone levels are elevated is really less than a week during fertility treatment, and that's in contrast, of course, to potentially 9 months of a pregnancy. And so I think if it's felt that it's safe for a woman to carry a pregnancy, then usually it's not such a stretch for the patient and their oncologist to undergo the hormonal treatment for an egg harvest. But, you know, in the cases where we feel like that is not a risk worth taking, women still have the option to use a gestational carrier, in other words, someone else that would carry her pregnancy, even though it's her embryo, if we feel like it's otherwise not safe.
Thank you, Doctor. The next listener I wanted to ask, could you throw some light on what a dose of radiation is appropriate in order not to cause harm to the reproductive parts? Is there a high risk and low risk dosage in that sense?
Yes, good question. So what we know is that, you know, radiation can affect fertility for men and women. It will depend on the total dose that's given and the target organ that's involved. For women and for men, when it affects the ovaries or the testicles, it can lead to a decrease in the number of eggs or a cessation of sperm production. If in a woman she has radiation to her uterus or her cervix, this may affect her ability to be pregnant later on, in other words, to carry the pregnancy. And we also know if there's radiation to the brain, this may block normal hormone production that's necessary for a woman to ovulate or for a man to produce sperm or testosterone. So we do know that certain types of radiation, particularly abdominal or pelvic radiation that exceeds 6 gray units, may present women or men with a very high risk of amenorrhea. For women, that means they don't get their periods, or azoospermia, which means for men that they do not have any sperm. And this is a condition they may not recover from. Similarly, the kind of radiation inherent to a stem cell transplant, a total body irradiation, also carries a high risk of this. Radiation to the head or brain that exceeds 40 gray units. I mean, certainly these are always in a spectrum. There's certainly no strict cutoffs, but these are the doses at which, you know, we are told that the risk is much higher. Typically, this would be information that we would work with radiation oncologists to determine what the total dose would be for those patients. And as much as possible, you know, we would try to shield those reproductive organs before radiation.
Well, thank you, Doctor. Suleika, this one has just come in. I think you have touched upon the cost of preserving fertility and how insurance doesn't cover it. So the minister wants to ask, do you have to pay every year for supporting the egg freezing for you, or is it just a one-time investment that they ask for?
That's
a good question, yeah. I'm sorry, was it?
Oh, was that for you or for me? Okay. So initially, I was storing my eggs at the clinic here in New York City where I did the egg preservation, and it was very expensive. I think it was about $500 every 6 months, which was prohibitive considering that I don't plan on using those eggs for several more years. Through this organization that I mentioned called Verna's Purse, I believe it's free. There might be a nominal fee of $75 or $100. I'm not sure of the exact fee, but it's pretty much completely covered, which is incredible.
Okay.
And I think if I can, if that's possible, yeah, I think
please,
that.
Please share your thoughts.
Suleika touched upon a great organization, and that is Fertile Hope. Fertile Hope is now a subsidiary of Livestrong. Fertile Hope does provide a number of excellent resources for men and women that have been facing cancer and have concerns about fertility. Educational materials there are interactive tools there to learn more about the impact of a particular diagnosis and treatment on your fertility. But also, most importantly, they can provide some direction in terms of finding a clinic that may be able to offer financial assistance or a discounted rates for egg freezing or embryo banking. In addition, you know, there are a number of pharmaceutical companies that will often provide a lot of the medications that are necessary for the egg freezing or embryo banking cycles for free. And again, maybe not all of the medications, but the bulk of the medications necessary can be covered. So it's certainly important to ask about these things if you're facing this type of treatment, because it certainly can get prohibitively expensive, and typically the bulk of the cost is going to be that initial egg freeze and egg harvest, which is those 2 to 3 weeks worth of medications, and then the surgical procedure to remove the eggs, which out of pocket could be as high as around $10,000 or more, depending on where you go, but does not necessarily need to be that high depending on where you go. And then, as Suleika said, there is a possibility for ongoing cryopreservation charges, every 6 months or every year.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is on ovarian transpositioning. The listener wants to wants you to explain a little bit about ovarian transpositioning and how it is used as an option for treating infertility in cancer.
Great. So ovarian transpositioning means that for certain types of cancer, when a woman is facing radiation to the pelvis, her radiation oncologist and her surgeon, usually a gynecological oncologist, will work together to come up with a plan to move the ovaries out of the way of the radiation, and then protect it from exposure. And so this minimizes the direct impact of the radiation. And there have been spontaneous pregnancies with them in this location. In some cases, they're too far out of the way and they need to be moved back into their original location for conception. And in some cases, let's say a woman has a hysterectomy and she has her uterus removed, her ovaries may still be left inside. She can still undergo IVF and the eggs would be harvested again, and then embryos created, and then usually put into a gestational carrier. So it's kind of an example there that gives you an idea of the a lot of different modalities that are used, from surgical conservation, transposition of the ovaries, and then assisted reproductive technologies.
Thank you, Doctor. The next question is, what is the minimum time that a cancer patient should wait to become pregnant after finishing cancer treatment? And what is the timeline given to men for the same?
That's a good question. And I have to say that in my shoes, typically this is a discussion between the patient and their oncologist. And usually I will wait until I have the green light from them to help the patient pursue pregnancy. I think broadly we would say probably 2 to 3 years, but I think this really varies on the patient and their prognosis and their overall fertility and cancer treatment plan. But, you know, it's important to think of some creative options sometimes. For example, if a patient's using an egg donor or if she's using a gestational carrier, in other words, someone else to carry the pregnancy, then it's actually medically possible for a patient to become a parent even while they're still undergoing treatment. So I'm not saying that this is necessarily the best way to go about it, but I'm just saying, there certainly are lots of options that they don't necessarily have to happen in tandem.
We have another question which says, in some cases of cancer, like prostate cancer and germ cell tumors, you may not get any viable sperms even before chemotherapy. So what is the cause of fertility preservation in such cases?
This is a good question. And typically we would manage these cases with a urologist who has a focus in infertility. And now what the urologist can then do is, in some cases, recover sperm through testicular sperm extraction procedure or epididymal sperm aspiration. In other words, they are able to basically take a biopsy and extract sperm directly. Now, sometimes there may not be sperm there in these cases, and sometimes they may just be at a low number. And in these cases, sometimes these samples can be frozen. And later on, these patients can still father a child through IVF with the use of a procedure called ICSI. What that means is the embryologist can isolate a single sperm and inject it directly into an egg. So in these cases, certainly spontaneous pregnancy would not be possible, but there is still a possibility to father a child with IVF.
Thank you, Dr. Ray. I think you've covered almost all the questions. I have a last one for Sulekha. Sulekha, we have a question that says, your blogs show that you have taken your diagnosis very sportingly and have been an inspiration to many young survivors. Now that you are in remission, do you feel you're all set to go back to what you wanted to do?
So this is a tough question, and it's something that I just wrote about today. and my life interrupted column in the New York Times. People like to think that you're done with cancer when you complete treatment. And I think that for a lot of patients, they never feel done in the sense that the fears of recurrence or the emotional struggles or just coming to grips with the fact that you're not the same person that you were before your diagnosis can be incredibly difficult. That being said, I feel incredibly grateful for the life that I have now. People sometimes say that cancer is a blessing, and I'm not sure that I personally agree with that. I think that my life is a blessing in spite of cancer, but cancer helped me to see all those things in my life that I'm grateful for that I maybe took for granted before. So I'm not really sure what the future holds, but I'm excited to find that out, and I feel very grateful for the many other cancer survivors that I've met through this experience who continue to be the cornerstone of my support system and the people who really carry me and help carry each other through not only the treatment part, but the aftermath.
That's amazing, Spirit. So, like, I'm wishing you the very best. So it was amazing. Great listening to both of you. And thank you for being here with us today. Matt, thank you to you too for having such a great co-host. And we'll be having the talk, the broadcast of the talk on our curetalks.com by tomorrow. And all listeners, for our details of upcoming talks, please visit www.curetalks.com. Thank you, everyone. It was great listening to you.
Thank you, Priya.
Thank you. Thank you, Sulika and Matt and Priya.
Yeah, thanks, everybody.